Over the past two episodes of Today in Focus, we've been delving into the case of the Freshwater Five, men found guilty of a conspiracy to import 250 kilos of cocaine, who insist they're innocent. Yesterday, we looked at the circumstantial evidence against them. Today, we look at the one piece of direct evidence that first got a miscarriage of justice lawyer interested in this case. Earlier this month, on an extremely cold and windy day on the Isle of Wight, me and my producer Josh go for a drive.
Been a breakdown in a country road in the Isle of Wight.
Through narrow country lanes.
There's a guy on a ladder.
Thank you.
Oh my God.
To this car park.
Very quiet today. Right, so here we are, Tennyson Downs.
Where we meet up with Emily Bolton.
Beginning the plod up to Tennyson Down. This is a walk I have done many times before.
She leads us up this muddy footpath.
Five steps and then step up. Five steps and then another step up.
That winds steeply uphill.
Just see Tennyson Monument peeping from the top, over the top of the horizon there, and a sign saying, "Take care, cliff edges can be dangerous."
I didn't put that through the risk assessment.
And we emerge at the top. It opens up onto this grassy cliff top.
It is foggy, isn't it?
All of a sudden, the wind is battering us.
Okay, God. That is so going to blow away. You know that, don't you?
And the entire horizon in front of us is dominated by the sea.
You could just see the sheer white cliffs in the distance.
But it's also beautiful. In a rugged English coastline sort of way.
Of all the cases, of all the criminal cases I've ever worked on, from New Orleans and all around the Deep South to England, I've got to say this one has the most spectacular alleged crime scene.
We walk about 20 minutes along the cliff edge with just a barbed wire fence between us and the sheer drop to the sea below.
I'm a bit scared I'm going to step off the edge.
And then we arrive at what is maybe the most important location in this entire case.
So this spot that we've come to now on Tennyson Down, this is where the only piece of direct evidence against the Freshwater Five is said to have developed.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Freshwater Part 3, the Clifftop Evidence. Before we get into it, let me just quickly remind you of a few details from the previous episode. In the prosecution timeline, the Galwad picks up the drugs from the Oriane just after midnight. It then potters around in the channel and in the waters around the Isle of Wight for about 17 hours. Then it heads for Freshwater Bay, which is where the 11 holdalls of cocaine would be found the next day. By then it's late afternoon. The weather has cleared up and the sun is shining. Now remember I told you that two police officers said they saw items being thrown over the side of the Galwad? Well, this is where that happened. Up on the cliffs at Tennyson Down, just along from the monument to Alfred Lord Tennyson, the Victorian poet. Point C, as it was called at trial.
So tell me what happened that evening. Who were the police officers and why were they here and what was their role in the wider operation?
So the two clifftop officers were seconded from the local police force, from Hampshire Police, to assist with this operation, I think at a fairly low level. Basically, they just needed manpower and these two officers were part of that group. And somehow they end up here on Tennyson Down. They testified that they had one set of binoculars that they were sharing between the two of them. They're supposed to be calling in their observations of what they see. One of them was holding a radio and reporting back to the logist. That's the person who writes down what officers are observing. And the other was slightly further out, like towards the cliff edge, observing the goal. So he's calling his observations.
So the two officers are up on this cliff, specifically watching the Galwad as it comes to bay. And everything they radio across is being written down in a log by another police officer stationed somewhere else on the island. Emily brought a copy of that log onto the cliffs to show us.
I'm slightly concerned that having a copy of the log in front of me on this cliff is going to result in it blowing out to sea, but...
It's like a book with margins. On the left-hand side, there's a column for the time of the observation. Then there is space to write what's being said. And on the right-hand side, there's another margin for the observing officers to sign later.
So what we have here is 1842 SU116, that's the Galwadi Moors number plate, is now stationary about a quarter of a mile from the coast facing east. Then at 1845...
There are a few more log entries like that where nothing much happens. And then the really important one.
1853, SU116 is moving westbound, throwing six or seven items overboard at intervals.
At trial, the men said that if they were throwing anything in the sea at that moment, it was waste, bait boxes and bags of rubbish. Or more specifically, I'll let Danny say it.
Literally bags of shit, because there's no toilet on the boat. And then once you're coming closer in and you're tidying up the boat, it gets launched overboard.
Nice.
But of course, the prosecution said these weren't bags of rubbish, but holdalls full of cocaine. If you've been listening closely, you may have noticed that something isn't quite adding up here. The contemporaneous log entry from the clifftop officers says six to seven items. But we know that 11 holdalls were found in the sea the next morning. That is quite a big discrepancy. Now, you may not think that matters, and we'll come to that later. But the first thing me and Josh wondered was how clearly can you see over that distance? Could they have seen something, but just not seen it very well? So we did an experiment.
OK, let's do it this way, right?
Maybe that's overstating it. Let's call it an exercise. The original plan was for Josh to get on a fishing boat and for somebody to drive him around exactly where the Galwad was at 1853.
And so what we're trying to establish was how clearly they would have been able to see what the Galwad were throwing over the edge.
And I would stand up on the cliffs and see how clearly I could see what he was doing on the boat. But as you know, the weather was terrible. It was windy. The sea was rough.
We're just looking out to sea now and it's like 10-foot waves like crashing against the shore. It looks absolutely horrible.
And the fishermen wouldn't let Josh onto his boat.
They're massive. Look at that. They're easy 10-foot.
So we improvised.
Yeah, so we've got... This is a sight line diagram.
About 5 minutes down the road is Freshwater Beach and above the beach are some cliffs. We know where the officers said they were at trial. They marked their position on a map.
So we're on the beach that basically laps around Freshwater Bay.
And we know where the Galwad was because it had a little computer on board recording its position. So we're pretty sure that the officers were around 300 metres away from the Galwad when they made their observation. So we thought, let's see what we can see from that distance.
The least scientific test ever devised. Right, here we go.
Now, we were using some binoculars we'd bought on Amazon a few days earlier, so not exactly industry standard police binoculars. And it was a fairly cloudy, borderline foggy day, instead of the bright, clear day when the clifftop observations were made.
Goods that I've bought from Morrison.
While Josh waited down on the beach, I climbed up to the top of the cliff and called him on my phone.
I want to stress that this is the opposite of a scientific experiment, but... So I can see Anushka walking away into the distance, walking up the beach, up towards this little cliff. She looks quite far away from me now, so... Oh, she's waving at me. Yeah? I'm holding up an object. Can you tell what it is?
Box of cereal?
It is a box of cereal.
Can you, boom!
Do you know what type of cereal it is?
Cheerios.
Cheerios, you're right, they are Cheerios.
There you go.
You'd never seen what was in this bag before.
I've never seen what's in that bag. Look, I have to be honest with you, although I am actually very, very far from you. From where I'm standing here, you're just a little light speck in the distance. I recognised immediately that it was a cereal box, and I think I sort of recognised the front a bit because I know what a box of Cheerios looks like.
Can you see what I've got in my hand now?
Football.
You're absolutely right. Right, final one. This is the hardest challenge of them all.
Like a can of Fanta.
you're not far off, but come on, Anushka.
Is it like alphabet spaghetti?
You're so close now.
Spaghetti hoops.
Do you want to know the answer?
Yeah.
Spaghetti hoops.
I just said spaghetti hoops.
Did
I just
you?
Said it. Yeah.
Oh, spaghetti hoops.
I just said spaghetti hoops. I said it before
oh,
you
man.
Said it. It's on tape. Don't worry.
Oh, well,
so I don't want to say our experiment, or should I say our exercise, proves anything conclusively. Maybe it's harder to see a boat bobbing up and down at sea. But what it does tell me is that on a cloudy, wintry day, squinting through cheap binoculars, I could be pretty sure of what I was seeing 300 metres away, and could even pick out enough detail to recognise, fairly quickly, a can of spaghetti hoops. OK, back up to the cliffs.
Camera, one of them had already indicated he had an iPhone with him. He was asked whether...
Maybe they didn't record what they saw very accurately because they just didn't think it was significant at the time.
Was there anything to indicate that the officers felt at the time they'd seen something significant?
The accounts from the officers at trial on that point are inconsistent. So one of the officers states that he was very aware of the significance of what he'd seen, found it very suspicious, and, you know, he's on a drugs operation. He's been tasked to look at a suspect vessel and he's seen something thrown in the water. The other officer said that he didn't find it significant.
Did the officers take photographs?
No, no photographs were taken. The officers were asked if they took photographs. They said they didn't have a camera. One of them had already indicated he had an iPhone with him. He was asked whether or not he took a photograph with the iPhone, and he said he didn't know how to.
So at this moment in time, this is what seems to be going on, at least going from what was recorded in the logs at the time. The two police officers are up on the cliffs. The log says they saw 6 to 7 items, and the fishermen say they have an innocent explanation for it. Not exactly a smoking gun at this point. You know what happens next. The Galwad leaves the bay, goes around the Needles, the rock formations on the western tip of the island, and back to its home harbour, Yarmouth. Then the soccer officers arrest the men. The two clifftop officers are actually there for this arrest. Then the police search the boat and find nothing. Given the clifftop officers are there and had just told the loggist that this very boat had unloaded items at Freshwater Bay, it's not clear why the search doesn't move there at this point. Then the clifftop officers go back to their hotel. The next morning, those two officers are ready to leave the Isle of Wight. They are literally at the ferry terminal waiting to depart. Then, at 8:30 a.m, the drugs are found. Not by the police, but by the random fishermen. 11 holdalls, all tied together with rope, attached to a buoy. In the bay, not too far from where those officers had been watching the Galwad the previous evening. The fisherman calls the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard calls the police. So by now, soccer officers know what has been found. Then there's a debrief, which is basically a meeting where the police officers discuss their observations and where they're supposed to sign their observations in the right-hand margin of the logbook. The two clifftop officers aren't there. And according to a later investigation by the Independent Police Complaints Commission, a record of the meeting misleadingly suggests that they are. Then, at about 10 a.m, according to their cross-examination in the original trial, just as the clifftop officers are about to leave the island, one of them gets a phone call. It's the operational commander, a senior soccer officer. He tells them, come and meet me in a car park. And according to the testimony of one of the clifftop officers, he reveals that the drugs have been found. At trial, this car park was described as being a small one in West Cowes near the chain link ferry. Josh insisted that we go to a car park, and he thinks maybe he's found the one they met up in. The only one that fits that description.
This is my educated guess.
I'm not sure. Anyway, we park up.
You sit in the driver's seat and open this window and I'll stand out here. You go around there.
And Emily rolls down the window of her Fiat Panda.
And so here we are in this small car park. Emily, what happened next?
So what happened, according to the clifftop officers, is that they were invited to meet the commander and sat in the back of his car and were presented with the log that had just been debriefed by all the other officers in the operation and were invited to review their observation of 6 or 7 items going overboard at intervals. So what had happened by this time, what you've got to remember is by the time that the clifftop officers are sitting in the back of the commander's car in a car park in Cowes, the drugs have already been found. The amendment X, which is the letter of the alphabet they use to tag their amendment, says the items appeared to be dark in colour and approximately the size of a large holdall. They were tied together on a line and were dispatched from the boat one after another, totaling 10 to 12. The last item was a red floating buoy. The 6 or 7 items overboard at intervals, which is the original log entry, now exactly mirrors the items found in the water that morning.
You can see why the defence focused so heavily on this in the original trial. This was the key eyewitness evidence. Police officers saying they had seen the men unload an exact description of the drugs into the sea. Slam dunk. At trial, the officer closest to the cliff edge said his recollection was of 10 to 12 holdalls going overboard, and he wasn't sure why 6 to 7 items had been recorded instead. The second officer, who radioed in the sighting, accepted that he said 6 to 7 items, adding he didn't think it was relevant to update the number or the description of what was seen. In her evidence, the logist said maybe she misheard because of a poor radio connection. Either way, Emily argues 6 to 7 doesn't sound anything like 10 to 12. And there's another thing that bothers me. They've seen 10 to 12 holdalls being thrown overboard when they are stationed to observe a specific boat of interest in a drugs operation, to see whether it does anything suspicious. Wouldn't the operation react when they radioed this in? They've just caught the men in the act, doing exactly what they were stationed to see whether they would do.
Why wouldn't they alert more senior officers?
That is the question. And the clifftop officers did say that they had called a senior officer. However, that senior officer was contacted and said he did not receive the call.
At trial, nobody else could recall this phone call being made. But if they had just said to a senior officer, hey, I've just seen holdalls being thrown into the sea, why did the police not immediately go around in a boat and find them? Remember, the police clearly don't know where the drugs are until the next morning. Testimony at trial is very clear on this. Even then, it's not the police who find them, but a random fisherman.
At trial, the position was that nothing was done about the sighting at 1853. No one reacted. No one sent anybody to check out the items. No one asked the clifftop officers to remain on the location, keeping the items secure. Nothing, no reaction from the operation whatsoever was what we were told at trial.
And then the clifftop officers went to their hotel ready to leave the island. There's a passage in the judge's summing up about all of this that is really striking. I'm going to read it directly. If the Crown are able to rely upon that evidence, then it would indeed be very strong direct evidence. And it's a matter for you, he's talking to the jury, it's not a matter for me. But he goes on, it does seem extraordinary, does it not, that if these officers, knowing that they are involved in an operation to detect drug smugglers, see what they have seen the night before, that they're prepared to leave the island, apparently completely unaware that the significance of what they have seen has been missed by everybody. And then again he says to the jury, "It's a matter for you, not for me." I'm going to be honest, all of this baffled me. The explanation as to why the log had changed from one thing to the other isn't very satisfying. And it seems really weird that Soccer didn't react there and then if two of their officers had just seen the drugs being thrown into the sea. I wanted to ask the police directly, but like I said before, the NCA, which is what Soccer is now called, couldn't talk to us for this series. We also approached a number of retired Soccer officers to see whether they could speak to us on the record, and they all said no. But from some of them and other police experts, we did hear concerns. Like, why was nobody taking any photographs? Why were these two local officers being used to watch the Galwad instead of Soccer's own highly trained officers? Some raised questions about the way the logs were written and the timeline of events. And they asked, why was nothing followed up? Did the two clifftop officers not tell their colleagues what they had just seen as they watched the Galwad's crew being arrested? But the former detective, Chief Inspector Lee Davis, who we heard from in the previous episode, says it's normal for officers to amend logs. It happens all the time, and thinks he can understand what happened that night.
And have you ever organised a big operation like this one?
Yeah, many times. Many times. So around firearms, around human trafficking, and around drugs. So my role as on the Eastern Region Organised Crime Unit was I was head of the operations directorate. So we would pick all of these operations up, and I had a number of senior investigating officers who would sit under me, who would run these operations on a day-to-day basis, but each of them would report into me daily so that we could discuss the way forward, partnership working, threat and risk assessment, and so on. You know, they're complicated, they are time-consuming, and they test you all the way along.
Can you tell me about the process of logging? How does it actually work?
So the loggers' job is to try and make sense of all the information that comes into them and for them to log it. But it's not an easy job.
Okay. And have you ever done that yourself? Have you ever been a logger?
Yeah, I've been a loggist many, many years ago when I was a young PC, I would be logging on operations. So I know how pressurized an environment that logging can be, and how challenging, because of course you've got various people communicating on a radio. Sometimes you'll just miscall somebody's call sign, so you won't quite be sure who's talking to you. You'll have to try and seek clarification on that, and when in that, you'll also, there's quite possibly that you'll have to be briefing other officers on what's happening.
Is it quite stressful?
Massively stressful.
And would you expect what is recorded to be accurate at the time?
Well, it would be accurate in terms of what the loggist has heard and being able to copy down. It doesn't mean, and it will often be the case, that when you then speak to those officers in a debrief, what you've got in your log won't correlate to exactly what they've seen. For a start, physically, you can't always get that message across in as much detail as you physically see. As a loggist, then receiving all that information, understanding who it's come from, and getting the context that they're operating in is challenging. So no, I wouldn't expect everything that's written in a log to stay in that format when you then do your debrief. There'll frequently be changes. I think the question you're asking me is, would I be suspicious when there is only one observation point and when the log therefore has to be changed? The answer to that is no, I wouldn't be surprised, because I know from the reality of having undertaken that task how many challenges there are in terms of getting a phone or a radio message through to a loggist in the right environment and then being able to record exactly what's being said. Because it isn't the ideal world. It isn't people sitting in a nice quiet room where they can pick up a phone and take their time making a call. They're trying to do it amongst the chaos of events moving in front of them, maintaining observation and concentration, and being able to communicate at a time and in a manner that the public around them aren't going to get suspicious. So they're not working in an ideal environment. What I would say to you is that log has been in front of the judge, and the judge has made a ruling on the admissibility of that evidence and obviously decided it could be included.
But the judge did say that certain things about this were extraordinary. And can I just ask you about a couple of them? Because I definitely see what you're saying about the chaos. I definitely see, you know, what you've done, which is really helpful, is bring it to life to feel quite different to when I'm reading it on a piece of paper. But I do think it is weird that they radio in, or at least that the logist hears what they radio in as 6 to 7, as opposed to 10 to 12. Because to me, the moment at which you remember most clearly what you see is the moment at which you see it. And I don't think 6 to 7 sounds like 10 to 12. And yet the next day, after the drugs are found, they get called back to a car park and then they amend the logs to almost exactly what's been found.
Okay. So look, as a senior investigating officer, whether somebody had seen 6 or 7 bags being put into the sea or 11 or 12 being put into the sea, do you know what? It doesn't matter to me. What they've seen is some activity where some bags have been put into the sea. I wouldn't be concerned if they said to me they'd seen 6 or 7, and when I get there, I find 11 or 12. That's a bonus. I wouldn't expect those officers to be able to see every single bag that was put into the sea or be able to identify whether it was one that went in at a particular time or two that went in at a particular time. For me, it's academic. It doesn't influence the evidence that we present. It just means the amount that they're saying they've seen is different, but they're not gaining anything. You know, if they originally say, I didn't see anything be put into the sea, and then further down in the log, you suddenly say, yeah, I saw lots of items being put into the sea. As an SIO, I'll be sitting there saying, hang on, I'm concerned here, explain this to me. The difference between 6 and 7 and 11 and 12 being put into the sea is neither here nor there as an SIO. We'll never know. I think that's the bottom line. We'll never know why the figures change. But I don't think it contaminates the evidence that's presented to the court.
If you're the commanding officer in this case, right, and these two police officers have seen something that once all the facts come together, clearly looks really dodgy, they saw 7 items being thrown off the side of a boat, the boat that you're interested in, but you don't, at that point you don't know that there are drugs, and then later you know that the drugs are found, and you absolutely believe 100% that what they saw were those drugs being, like, lopped off board. Is it possible they were, like, absolutely certain that that is what they saw and they sharpened up the evidence?
Okay, so I'll answer this totally honestly from how I would operate, how my teams would operate. Not a chance of that happening. Absolutely, yeah. No chance of that happening. Do you know why? Because we're all vetted to a certain level, and we are in elite jobs that are hard to get into, and we don't ever want to lose. There wouldn't be a culture in any team that I operated where we would allow that to happen, because you don't need it to happen. It's ridiculous. And we always had the motto, no job is worth my job. So I would always be saying to my teams, your integrity comes first. If I can't trust you as an individual, I can't have you working in that environment. So the concept of doctoring evidence to make it more compelling is ridiculous. Honestly, genuinely, it's ridiculous. Because you know what? My mentality would be, if we don't get them tonight and they're doing this, we'll get them in 2 weeks' time. We'll get them in a month's time. We'll get them in 2 months' time. It doesn't happen. I promise you, in every environment I've ever worked, it does not happen. We don't sharpen evidence. There is no point. The risk of what would happen to you against what you gain is just not proportionate.
Coming up, another drugs bust and another set of amended logs. There's one more thing that I want to tell you about. In the course of researching this, we came across something else. It was a judgment from a Court of Appeal case. A seemingly unrelated case. Until you realise that it involved the same logist and the same operational commander. The guy who sat in the car park while the clifftop officers amended their logs. And it turns out, when you read that judgment, that about 8 months earlier, these same individuals were involved in another drug smuggling surveillance operation. And the logs were amended in that case too. A woman came through security at Gatwick Airport with 2.5 kilograms of cocaine. And another guy was on the other side of security. He was supposed to be part of the conspiracy too. The contemporaneous log reported the woman coming through, and then about 12 hours later, an amendment was made. The new entry described the woman raising her left arm with her fist clenched and then lowering it while making eye contact with the man, who then smiled. As in, like doing a fist pump, that they had got the drugs into the UK. None of that was recorded at the time. It was written later in a debrief. There were other amendments too. And it was suggested in that case too that the loggist must not have been writing down everything that was said. The Court of Appeal judgment in the Gatwick case said the alterations to the log were extensive, the evidence of the officers was inconsistent, and notable detail relied on by the officers in evidence was lacking in the original section of the log. The court ended up quashing the conviction. It went to retrial and the jury acquitted. The Court of Appeal actually referred to the Freshwater case, to our case. And in fact, failure to explore the clifftop evidence in the Freshwater case had a bearing on why the Gatwick conviction got quashed. The chronology is complicated. Even though the events at Gatwick happened before Freshwater, the Gatwick trial that the Court of Appeal was considering happened after the Freshwater trial. And the Court of Appeal decided that the Freshwater stuff, the stuff about the clifftop officers, should have been disclosed in the Gatwick trial. And because it wasn't, the conviction was unsafe. This is the Court of Appeal referring to the Freshwater case. In our judgment, it would have been open to a jury to conclude that events tended to indicate that, and then they name our operational commander and logist, were prepared to break the rules as regards compiling observation logs. They add, there is a sustainable basis for a court to conclude that the senior officer had taken steps to persuade two local officers to give false observation evidence that linked the fishing boat with the holdalls that were later discovered. So, another case, some of the same officers, and a similar amendment to the logs. In that case, the conviction was overturned. In the first episode, you might remember me saying that Nikki Green made a complaint to the IPCC. That's the Independent Police Complaints Commission, as it was called back then. Well, they looked at all of this. They found inconsistencies in the evidence of the clifftop officers, but these were not sufficient to demonstrate that they had fabricated their accounts. It was also accepted that there had been failings in the administration of the logs, but there was no case to answer regarding misconduct. And one thing I wonder about is how all of this actually affected the trial. With the notable exception of the stuff that emerged in the Court of Appeal case, everything else we've talked about in this episode was discussed in the trial. The two clifftop officers were cross-examined. I've read the transcripts, and they were pretty tough cross-examinations. And as I said, the judge called some of the evidence extraordinary. It was all heard by the jury, and the men were still convicted. I spoke to other criminal defence barristers about what might have happened in this case had this evidence been kept out of court entirely. And one of them said it's possible that they still might have been found guilty on the strength of everything we've heard in the previous episode. In the UK, a jurisdiction where it's illegal to talk to jury members about their deliberations, we can never ask questions like that. We can never know, and it's a fool's errand to guess. But what about if there was more evidence? Evidence that wasn't heard at the original trial. Evidence that would have suggested that it may have been completely impossible for the Freshwater Five to collect the drugs, and that there might have been another suspect boat in the area at the time. That's tomorrow in Freshwater Part 4. We went to the National Crime Agency, the successor to SOCA, about this episode, putting specific allegations to them and asking if the individual officers wanted to comment. But they said it would be inappropriate to comment with the Court of Appeal hearing next week, as did the Crown Prosecution Service. The Independent Office for Police Complaints, the successor to the Independent Police Complaints Commission, did respond to our request for a statement. They confirmed that the IPCC carried out an investigation into whether two soccer police officers colluded to manufacture evidence to support the prosecution case in the Freshwater case. A spokesperson said, "The IPCC started an investigation in July 2012, which concluded in March 2013. Having examined the evidence given at the criminal trial, obtained accounts from the officers involved in the operation, and looked at mobile phone records, it determined that while there were inconsistencies in the evidence provided by two of the officers, they were not sufficient to demonstrate that the officers fabricated their accounts. Furthermore, there was no evidence to suggest that the third officer conspired with the other two to manufacture evidence. The complaints that these three officers fabricated evidence and committed perjury were therefore not upheld." That's it for today. Thanks for listening to this series. We'd love any reviews and tweets. This series is produced by Josh Kelly, with support on today's episode from Alex Attack. Sound design and original music is by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We will be back with part four tomorrow.